Welcome to Keeping Your Together in a Stressed World with Michelle Post and Scott Grossberg. Each week, we explore down and dirty ways to stop awfulizing, catastrophizing, going down the rabbit hole, and moving through all the craziness that is happening right now. We're here to create a community of like-minded people as we give you tips, tricks, and techniques for keeping sane in an unhinged world. And now, here are your hosts, Michelle Post and Scott Grossberg.
Hey, everybody. This is Scott Grossberg, one of your co-hosts for the podcast, Keeping Your Shit Together in a Stressed World. And I'm here with my terrestrial co-host, Michelle Post, who I believe has firmly planted her feet back at home. Yeah?
Yes, correct. I am home now. Hi, everybody. Hi, Scott. So Thanks for putting up with my travels.
You are a true digital nomad.
I am. Onward and upward. Yep. I start again next month. Next month, I have another long trek. It's only 3 weeks long, but still.
So the rest of the, by the way, the rest of us now need to live vicariously through you.
Okay.
So you can report all this stuff. By the way, you're on all the social media. We both are, but you guys, if you're not following us on social media, you might enjoy it. So you can reach out to, or you can follow us on, I know I'm on Facebook, LinkedIn, Instagram, Threads, X, you pick it. I'm probably there. Michelle, you're on almost all of them, right?
I am on LinkedIn, Facebook. I check the least, sorry, Instagram, X/Twitter. Still can't call it X, but I don't know what Threads is. What's Threads?
Threads is the competitor to X.
Oh, okay.
So it's
all right.
You know me. I'll be an early adopter to just about everything. which by the way is a great tie-in to today's topic. So today we're talking about the creative brain, and more importantly, when you're unaware of being unaware, something very near and dear to my heart that we'll chat about today. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that everybody is aware of how important this whole awareness thing is. And we'll delve into it in a little bit. Before I get into where I wanted to start with it, I do have to ask, Michelle, do you ever notice, and I'm going to ask this very generally, do you ever notice that when people come into you for a therapy session, when they're like there and when they're not there, when they're just being aware of what's going on?
Yes. Yes. When they're present and when they're distracted, absent-minded, somewhere else, thinking of something else. Yes, absolutely.
And so I thought a good way to start this whole discussion of being unaware of being unaware, is just a discussion of what awareness is, right? We can't talk about being unaware if we don't know what being aware is. And so I went to the Oxford Dictionary, and being aware is the knowledge or perception of a situation or fact. And as you just put it very wonderfully, it's being present. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that I love and that I have studied, particularly in the context of hypnotherapy and neurolinguistic programming. Yeah. I'm going to couple that with my knowledge of people based on 40 years of being a trial lawyer, where I had to be able to get in to the root source code of the way they were thinking, right? I had to deal with people who were unaware on a jury box, who were not present in a jury box. I had to capture their imaginations and be creative. That's how this all ties together. And so one of the things that I studied early on was something called the four levels of awareness. Mm-hmm. And I don't think most people are even aware of these. Now, there are different versions of this. I want to caution everybody that when you go online and you look up the four levels of awareness or consciousness, you're going to see different models. The one I like in particular, I saw originally from Michael Beckwith, who you guys have heard me talk about before, Reverend, and I love his philosophy and approach to things. Mm-hmm. I don't know where he got it from. I don't know that he invented it, but it's something that I saw through him. And it's the four levels of consciousness or awareness, and it literally comes down to four things that I'll just share with everybody. First, there's an awareness that he calls as me.
Okay.
And that is the belief that life is me, right? Okay. Everything's happening and it's me. Then there's to me, where it's the awareness that I'm the victim, right? Life happens to me. We've talked about this on the show before, by the way, with external factors. Generally, by the way, when you are in a to-me awareness state, you're generally looking at external factors and it becomes a very codependent situation. It's pretty bad.
Okay.
Right? Then there's through me,
okay,
which is the awareness that life cooperates with you.
Okay.
And that it's a partnership. And then finally, there's a by me. So here's the magician part of me, right? This is the I make life happen.
Okay.
Now, I bring these up because we're talking about being unaware of being unaware in a creativity place. And as a creative, as someone who works very intuitively from the heart, from the gut, right? I've said this before. When I write, it feels like I have downloads. It's not consciously sitting down. Mm-hmm. And so for me, it's very much creativity is a through me awareness state.
Okay.
That said, I've joked before, I love having written. I don't necessarily like writing. I've gotten better. And so for all you creatives, I think most of you, at least most of the people I work with in a coaching scenario, are in the through me awareness state. They're just tapping into this higher source, oversoul, whatever they want to call it, their muse.
Mm.
And they need to be aware of that rather than the situations, and I've done this myself, where you sit down at your appointed time for writing. By the way, any of you who are writers, right? It's a profession if you do it professionally.
Mm-hmm.
And we sit down at specific times and we write specific amounts of words. That's the key. And if you ever sit down and study the creative habits of very well-known authors, you will find that's what they do. They sit down at specific times. They have writing periods.
Mm-hmm.
And at times, they move from a through-me state to a by-me state.
Uh-huh.
And they just freaking will it into existence.
Like the artist's way, that's a morning pages ritual where you have to write 750 words in the morning. It doesn't matter how long it takes you, but 750 words is the goal. And when I have been doing morning pages, I don't do it consistently, but when I have, I notice that I need all 750 words to get past the bull crap. Meaning,
yeah,
like, there's many
absolutely
times where I'm like, oh, this, oh, that. Is that 750 words yet? No. That's only 200. Okay. There's this, there's that. Is that 150? No, we're still at 300. Okay. And it's really somewhere the magic tends to happen for me, somewhere around 350 to 400 words, where I really get into the process of being with. So I don't know if that's with me. So if we're talking about Michael Beckwith, what would with me be?
Well, so what you're doing, it sounds to me, you are literally at the by me phase until you hit that sweet spot.
Yeah.
And then, and I can't really tell from what you're saying, at that point, then you're writing either waffles through it, just a download.
Yeah.
Or you're one with the page and it's flowing, which is as me.
Yeah. It's either through me or as me that I experience. Uh-huh.
So it's
more enjoyable than the by me. The by me is trudging through mud.
Right. Oh. And so I don't know. By the way, I don't know many consistently successful creative people who take a to me approach where they say that the creative concept and phase and that the artist's struggle is a to me where all of this is happening to them. Oh, poor you. I don't know many consistently successful people who take that approach.
Yeah, I don't either.
So that said, the interesting thing is while I've given you the, what I'm going to call the Michael Beckwith model, again, prefacing that I don't know that he created it other than that's where I learned it from. There are some other types of awareness that I thought would be important before we get into it. Okay. And these are drastically different. They're as valid. It's just a drastically different way to look at awareness. The first one is environmental awareness. And this is where, you know, we've joked before about, please don't put me on a deserted island with no digital stuff. And I've got to actually lay out in the sun and enjoy myself. Just don't do that to me, right?
Poor you.
Poor me. So that's environment. It's where you find yourself in a relaxing situation or you find yourself in a stressed situation. And many of our listeners have been in a situation, I believe, where if you find yourself stressed, aggravated, et cetera, the harder you try to relax, the more stressed you get.
You know, this I had a nutty supervisor who taught me how to do biofeedback and relaxation training with people way back in early, like 2000. And he used to stand over top of his biofeedback clients and be like, wow, you're really stressed. You're not relaxed at all. Relax, relax. You got relax. And it, I mean, I thought that is not me. I don't know how that's ever effective. I've got to find a different way to take what he's teaching me and do it differently. I found it to be so funny because, you know, talk about an oxymoron, right? Relax, relax more. You need to relax harder. Relax
harder. Yeah. Great coach.
Literally happened, people. Actually happened.
So again, when you have a level of environmental awareness, this is where all of our episodes, and in fact, our home study course, we teach mindfulness practices.
Yes.
This is where it becomes really good for you because it helps you break away from those disruptive thoughts. Yep. And it creates what I call those pattern interrupts. Yep. So that's the first level. Then there's something called imagined patterns. And this is the lens through which you look at the world. I routinely ask people, we've done it on this show where I've quoted the Einstein saying that one of the most important questions you can ask yourself is the world friendly? Is the universe friendly? Right? Mm-hmm. That's a lens through which you look. Michelle and I have chatted before about, do things happen for a reason? And at times, Michelle, you and I have drastically different approaches mm-hmm. to that concept. Mm-hmm. Those are imagined patterns that you and I bring to, that's an awareness that we bring, that it's all based on something in our brain that has tipped us to whatever lens that we bring. You can't, by the way, I want to point out, you can't feel, at least I can't, being unaware. The point of this show is to make you aware that there are unaware portions of you going on. There are what I like to call programs running, and we'll get to that before we end the show today. There are programs running, subconscious programs running, that you actually are not aware of until you listen to this show. The whole concept of this show for me is to make you very aware that these programs exist, even if you're not always aware of them. Very similar to, you're not spending time telling your heart how to beat. You are not spending your time telling your lungs how to breathe, your pancreas how to produce insulin, your eyes to blink. This, until I say those things, you are not aware, you're unaware of those situations. Now, can you control them? Absolutely. But they also are an automatic pilot. They're going to run with you or without you until you're dead. The next level of awareness is judgment. And we've talked about the storytelling concept before, particularly when we have done the cognitive distortions and fallacy thinking programs that we've done. and be aware that this is your, I like to call it confabulation, because I dealt so much with that as a trial lawyer. And this is where we as human beings, the level of awareness, we can't stand a vacuum. We can't stand not knowing things. And so we just make shit up. And this is this leads us to the fundamental truth that everybody lies. And the scary part is we lie to ourselves in order to fill in the blanks. So confabulation, very simply, is if you know fact A and you know fact D, you will make up facts B and C, even if they're not really facts. You told yourself a story in order to connect those sequentially. You're going to do it in a self-esteem setting. You're going to do it in an ego setting. Some of you will be doing these storytelling awareness patterns out of survival based on your background. And a lot of this, by the way, it's not nurture or nature. It's nurture and nature, which lead and lend themselves to our storytelling situations. And then finally,
can I interrupt as an example, like a negative example of that, making up fact A, and you know fact A and you know fact D, but you make up B and C. When we don't include children in things like understanding death and dying, or how someone died, or even just mental health around them, children for survival have to make things about themselves. So depending on their age, usually 3 to at least 18, typically, when things happen in their environment, they tend to blame themselves. So if you are abusive to me, or I must deserve it, right? That's the fact B and C that gets ingrained in the trauma brain, is if you're abusive to me, if you're harming me and you're hurting me, and you're supposed to be a loved one or supposed to be my friend, I must deserve it. I'm not good enough. I'm bad. I deserve this. If I could just be better, this behavior would stop from this person. And that's the hard part, because then they carry that belief forward into adulthood. So I really do understand at a mental health level how this judgment being the next level of awareness and the confabulation really makes things difficult for people's personal well-being.
So without going into too many personal details, I had I'm going to call it the great honor of working with a 2-year-old yesterday, believe it or not. I had never met this wonderful little girl before, and I'm not going to go into the whole story, but unfortunately, she was in a head-on collision with her mom, and her mom was killed, and she wound 2 years old, folks, and she wound up with a broken arm, and she showed up where we were yesterday, and she came in with her little cast, and you can imagine the trauma brain that was going on, right? Mm-hmm. 2 years old, you're not aware of being unaware. This is a great example of this. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things, she was just scared of everybody. Grandma had brought her in and introduced me to her. And you could just see she was so timid and didn't want to talk and whatever else. And make a lot, very long story short, we spent most of the day with her and some other kids. This little girl was walking around in her little cast, and she's just adorable, but so timid. And I asked her if I could do some magic for her.
Oh, Scott, that's awesome.
2 years old. 2 years old, right? And it's like, I'm trying to figure out, okay, now that I've committed myself, what the hell am I going to do? And they were out by the pool, and they had this little water ball, and this little girl with her big brown eyes opens up and nods. She wouldn't talk. And I said, could you come over here? And I took one of these little water balls, and I was making this thing disappear. Her eyes got as big as saucers. And I said, if you want to do this, I'm going to give you the magic. You have to say poof. That was her magic word.
Poof.
And so she started going poof. And then she started pointing to where I would make where she wanted these balls to reappear. And we were doing that. And, eventually she was talking, she was showing she's walking around going, poof, poof. She wanted the ball to come out of her dad's ear. And it was just very, so cool. Aww. And then of all things, she wanted me to sign her cast.
Aww.
2 years old. So I drew a little Batman on it, and I wrote poof. Right. So this is a thing that beautiful. This is 2 years old with this emotional brain, this trauma brain that you were talking about, which leads to the next level of unawareness, and that's emotional unawareness. Mm-hmm. And this is it's challenging because I think, as you've noted before, we have emotional pain and we have emotional discomfort. Mm-hmm. And we may not even know what it is. We don't have the tools, whether you're 2 years old and you just don't have the maturity for it, or you're 50 years old, and to you, everything's still a threat out there. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What can we do then to break or interrupt that pattern? Mm-hmm. I use magic to break that pattern, right? This is what shamans of old were so good at, mm-hmm. right? Whether you believe in magic or not is irrelevant. Mm-hmm. Which doctors knew what they were doing psychologically, emotionally, and they knew how to tap into your unawareness, mm-hmm. so that it would bypass the critical faculties that were going on. So, I mean, I don't know, it, you know, when I talk about this, what do you think from a therapy standpoint of, for example, using magic to just bring some freaking smiles to people? Mm-hmm.
From, I mean, I think joy, fun, laughter are balms for the BALMS, balms for the heart and for healing. You know, laughter is the best medicine. Laughing yoga, bringing light, focusing on joy and magic and mystery and curiosity. There's quite, you know, in terms of the creative brain, we have to be in a creative space in order to allow those things to speak to us. You know, when we're in a dampened, dark, depressive state, our brain is usually not creative, except in that it makes up more ways to tell us we're bad or not good. That's the only kind of creating that's going on, is that I'm not good. It's hopeless. It's helpless. Everybody would be better off without me. But to bring magic and light and joy into someone's life when they have a little cast on their arm and they're coming in to see the doctor. I mean, I think there's a reason why doctors give out stickers and teachers give out stars. And, you know, when kids face difficult times, rewards and joy can be a way of motivating them to keep going, motivating them to keep staying present.
Yeah. So to put it another way, basically we are taking hopeless and helpless and replacing it with hope and a refrain, an expectation. Yes. And I want to point out that before we get into just some further technical discussion, that my experience in working with people, there's a whole diagram we could go through. I'm just going to talk about a portion of that. And that's that the actions that you take, the behaviors, the mm-hmm. habits, right? The mm-hmm. habitual patterns that you deploy actually come from your past. Mm. It's the stuff you've learned. I think you would agree with that, Michelle, that you see that all the time. And whether these habitual patterns are positive or negative, obviously just kind of depends on the interpretation that we've given it. Which then leads me to letting people know that your unawareness is actually the more authentic part of you, because it's never possible for you to really see things the way they are. You're bringing that lens to it, right? Michelle and I dealt with this every day with witnesses. Mm-hmm. No two people will ever recount the same situation the same way. It just doesn't happen. And understand that your lens, how you bring your worldview to a situation, is your version of reality. It's not anybody else's. Mm-hmm. And you, out of survival, your awareness of someone else's level of reality is not there. Again, that's where mm-hmm. the shamans, that's the witch doctors, the therapist mm-hmm. like Michelle, the coaches mm-hmm. like me, that's our job to come in and make you aware of things the way they really are.
Right.
Or to help you understand what's real and what isn't.
Mm-hmm. Because if we take, a family or a couple or two coworkers together because of that exact thing you just said, that since we're not with another person all day long and we're not aware of what they're going through or what they're doing, we overestimate the amount of effort we've put into something and we underestimate the amount of effort that someone else has put into it. So even if the accuracy is, you know, I put in 70% effort and this person put in 30% effort, like there is a differential there, we will still see it as like, oh, I did 80, 85% of the work. This person did 20, 15% of the work. We still don't see the imbalance accurately, right? So this is why people fight. You fight. Two college students fight that one person had to do more of the work on a presentation than the other in a group assignment. A couple, you did more of the dish, you do the dishes way less than you need to. You know, they fight about that because we're not with each other all the time. Therefore, we can't possibly be aware of the other person's presence all the time. And we overestimate our involvement and underestimate another person's involvement. It's a confabulation aspect of our brain.
Absolutely. And so we got about 5-6 minutes left.
Oh, you know, dang.
I want everyone to understand that a really basic way of understanding the level of your unawareness is the use of language. And I want to go back to the whole concept of cognitive distortions. It's how you talk to yourself, are the threats real? I was just dealing with someone this morning, as a matter of fact, and I was listening to levels of threats that they were talking about and had to actually back them off of them by using some of the Byron Katie things that we've talked about. Is that real? Can you be absolutely certain that's real? And when you get beyond the fight or flight responses of our nervous system, things take on a different approach. So I want everybody, first and foremost, in determining the level of your unawareness, to start listening to the self-talk that's going on, because we are constantly bombarded in the news and constantly bombarded with advertisements that distort what's actually going on in the world. Right? I've worked with people who listen to the news and they are in literally fight or flight mode, that they're not even where these things are happening.
I know.
So there's that. Number two is be aware of your own self-esteem. I don't mean your ego. It means, who are you in the world? How do you walk through it? Michelle has talked before, or just a little bit earlier, do you view yourself as less than somebody else? Are you doing the comparison and the contrast? What is it that you're doing using these cognitive distortions to literally demean yourself? And I fully believe, we've actually done shows on this, I fully believe that when we name things, we stick it in a box and then it's that way forever. And wouldn't it be wonderful from a self-esteem standpoint, I'm going to go back to the show we did with James Wanless, to be more like your animal pet, your dog or your cat, who are opportunistic and they don't sit around. They don't sit around with this whole awareness that they're a dog.
No.
They just don't do it.
Or that they only deserve certain things. Oh, you can go ahead and eat that because I've already had enough, and so you can steal my food from me.
No. By the way, nobody has told Presley Pearl, who is a small dog, that she's not bigger than this mastiff that was over the other day. Nobody has told her. There's no awareness of that.
Right.
Is unaware that she's little and this thing could step on her and kill her.
Right.
She's the alpha dog. She is the alpha dog.
That's her pattern. She's sticking to it.
And the mastiff bought it, by the way. It cowered around her. And then this is right up your alley, Michelle. And that is another thing that I find adds to the level of unawareness that we have, is your anger management tools. right? You know, and I'm not going to tell you that I'm immune to it. I've had moments of just pure rage where it feels like I've stepped outside myself and I'm watching myself. And it's not red, it's white. It's like this whole thing. It's I just become, what is it that the Hulk said, Bruce Banner said, don't make me mad, you won't like me when I'm mad. And I have worked very, I've worked very hard on anger management issues for that reason, because I understand I'm a freaking warrior, right? That was my job, was to go into court and fight for my clients. And so part of what you can do, the big, one of the huge takeaways from this show is to work with your anxiety and anger.
Absolutely.
To help you come to true awareness. And that's where someone like Michelle can help, right? Because you work with anger management issues with people, don't you?
Anger management, anxiety. One quick tip when we look at cognitive distortions, I just talked to a client about this recently. I'm not asking my clients when they look at balanced thinking to put sugar on a pile of shit and call it a brownie. I'm not asking for that. But I am asking them for them to clearly say, is this really a pile of shit? Or is this just a shitty brownie? Or is it actually a really delicious brownie? That's where we're headed, right? Because if you're used to baking, at some point when you put that baking soda in and the sugar hasn't hit that flour yet, you are dealing with a pretty nasty tasting piece of batter, right? So sooner or later, are we headed towards something delicious? You know, are we just kind of in the middle right now, or is it really as bad as I'm setting myself up to believe? That's a trick. Ask yourself, is this a pile of shit? Is this a shitty brownie, or is this a brownie? Where are
we? So one of the things that I do in conclusion for today, because we're at the end, one of the things that I like to do when I work with people, and I do not do this with everybody, please don't get a hold of me and say, hey, can you do hypnosis on me? I don't work that way. But if you find yourself with a good hypnotherapist who is willing to take on new clients or patients, you know, that's why I love getting into hypnosis. That's, you know, I used it during my studies for law school. I use it still today when I work with folks and myself. And that's the ability to get past using hypnosis, which bypasses your critical faculty.
Yeah.
Using hypnosis to bypass the critical faculty, which means your awareness, the parts of you that says, this can't happen, I can't do this, I'm not good enough, I'm not that. And then I have the ability to, doing that technique, then talk to your unaware parts. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing. You know, we always think about the fact that we always believe, I should say, that our unaware parts, our subconscious and our unconscious, those are two different things, folks, that they have no voice, when in fact, that's the real voice that's going on. And so there is an ability, I just let everybody know, there, that's a little tease, there is a way using hypnosis, using neuro-linguistic programming. There are different versions of this and different names for it, but it's bypassing the conscious awareness and then talking to the unconscious and subconscious parts of you to determine what the talk is that's really going on, the scripting. And then it becomes a very simple thing, believe it or not, to ask the subconscious or unconscious if it's willing to work with your conscious part to resolve any issues or anxieties or stresses or whatever is going on. And then you just let it happen. It's part of the, again, it's part of the process. There are other ways of doing this. Brain spotting, we've talked about on the show before, is a wonderful technique. You go to someone like Michelle or anybody else that does narrative or talk therapy. There are various ways for you to start becoming more aware of your unawareness. And it's just, for me, it's a fascinating journey.
Absolutely. Yes. And hopefully for some of you that this has inspired, you will dive deeper into this and maybe get a guide, because for the parts of you that are unaware, it's really hard to become aware of them without a guide.
You need an awareness. You need an awareness Sherpa. An awareness Sherpa.
A religious leader or spiritual guide or a hypnotherapist or a traditional psychotherapist, or just you need a guide to help you.
Yeah,
dive
even,
into
even
this.
If it's a spiritual coach, for lack
yep.
of a better way to put it.
Yep.
There are lots of people out there. All right, mm-hmm. next week, something right up your alley. We're going to talk about stress relief for caregivers.
Yes, absolutely.
Which is, I think, absolutely critical in this day and age where we are seeing fewer and fewer, at least here in America, doctors and nurses and physician's assistants. I'm personally shocked by how few people are starting to get back into it, right? Mm-hmm. They're just a shortage. I don't go, here in America, go try and set a doctor's appointment for a specialist and see how far out they put you.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So whether you're a professional caregiver, paid or an unpaid caregiver of somebody in your life, this is the episode for you. So tune in next time.
All right. With that, folks, may you have more awareness this week. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You've reached the end of another episode of Keeping Your Together in a Stressed World with Michelle Post and Scott Grossberg. If you like our show, we'd love for you to subscribe, rate our broadcast, and leave a review. The podcast is for general information only and not intended to be legal or mental health advice, nor the formation of a lawyer-client, nor therapist-patient relationship. Stay tuned for our next episode, and thank you for listening.